And she's reading from John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11.
I definitely get the easier one. Then each went to his own home, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left, with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin."
Oh, boy. I get the subject of chastity. Yikes. So I thought I would focus on the fact that chastity is not necessarily celibacy. Chastity is directing our love in appropriate ways. A chaste life leads us to put love in its right place. Keeping ourselves pure means so much more than not having sex until you're married. Okay, so maybe I don't need to talk about sex so much. But then I started looking for articles on this topic, and I was quite disheartened. Most of them were written by males, a lot of times Catholic priests. Some talked about the woman as a temptress, how a man needs to protect himself, as one author put it, against the wicked woman and her wiles. Needless to say, there's no way I'm going to get away with preaching a sermon on chastity and not talking about sex. So I might as well just get it over with. Now, in the Reflector, if you've happened to read it or if you read it later, in my article I talk about I want to start dwelling on the positive, not so much on the negative, more on the positive. Well, I'm sorry, but I'm going to be a little bit negative here for a bit. Our scripture today says that the woman caught in adultery is standing alone. She's standing alone twice. The first time is when she is accused. Verse 4 says, "They said to him, 'Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery.'" The Pharisees are testing Jesus, and they want to trap Jesus by creating a situation where he needs to choose between his ideas of forgiveness or what the law of Moses says. So they're trying to catch him, but it's not that they just happen to see a building and a woman leaves and someone who's not her husband leaves later, and oh my, what must be going on? They see the man and the woman in the very act of adultery. So then all of a sudden, here's the woman alone. What happened to the man? Maybe they were making the whole thing up, staged it so they could trap Jesus, and then they said to the man, "You've done your part, now you can go home." Whatever the case, this woman is standing alone in front of a group of men and in front of Jesus. Now, I got to thinking, maybe that part of Scripture is what made God-fearing, Bible-believing men think that Jesus would condone making women stand up in front of church and confess when they were caught in sin. They held no rocks in their hands, but the accusation was there. The first time I remember this happening was when I was in grade school. The older sister of a classmate of mine was up front in church, alone, unmarried, and pregnant. I was young. I didn't know at the time what was going on, but she was crying and her mother was crying. And then my mother later gave me a very, very vague explanation of the whole thing. The next time was when I was in high school, and a young woman's boyfriend and his family were part of the church, but this woman was not. She wanted to become a member of the church. Now, you might wonder why, because she had to stand up in front of everybody and confess that she had sinned. But she did it, and she stood up there alone. And I was away at college when my sister, pregnant and unmarried at 17, confessed her sin in front of the congregation alone. There are a lot of other rules put into place for women. The idea was that men had to protect themselves from lust. And apparently the only way they could do this was to ask women to dress in a modest way. Care must be taken that the man did not stumble, because it would be the woman's fault. I was in grade school when a woman, a fine Christian woman who was married to a nice Christian man, she was a mother of four children, and she had nothing unchaste in her background, came to church one day wearing a red coat. And she was told she should not wear that red coat, because red is the color of a harlot. Oops. In high school, in the early to mid-70s, we were not allowed to wear pants to school. So instead of wearing pants that covered our legs, we wore short skirts and dresses. And you got sent to the principal's office or the superintendent's office if any teacher saw you wearing a skirt that they thought was too short. And the rule was you had to stand with your hands here, and that skirt could be no shorter than where your fingertips touched on your leg. I wonder how chaste the mind of the superintendent was as he studied girls' dresses all day long. But my sister and I wore each other's clothes. We traded off. She was taller than I was. She had longer arms than I did. So I could wear a dress she couldn't wear. Her arms were longer, and the skirt would come to here, but on me, my fingertips caught. What sort of sense, really? Purity culture is a fairly new teaching among youth groups. At first glance, purity culture brings to mind visions of setting ourselves apart from the world and being good girls and boys, good women and good men. The problem is that the purity culture instead shames girls and women by saying that they are responsible for the thoughts and actions of boys and men. I encourage you to find Amy Lapp's blog. Can you put it up there? Just excuse me. It's entitled Moldable Jesus Part 1, When Jesus is Dressed in Shame. And there's the what you can type in. It's very disheartening, and a number of other words. Amy says, purity culture in the church undergirds rape culture because when it trains up children in the way they should go, it trains up boys to accept that rape is justifiable when they are sufficiently tempted by the woman in question. Conveniently, the church also simultaneously fails to teach girls about consent while also training them from a very young age to internalize the shame, teaching them both explicitly and implicitly that their bodies are an inherent temptation to men and thus should be treated and managed as such. So purity culture is another way that separates us. Somehow, shame sneaks into our hearts and minds and causes us to believe that our sin defines us. And even worse, we are tempted then to look at other people's sins and think that we are entitled to judge them by what we see. When my sister confessed her sin, there were folks sitting in the congregation who had also had premarital sex, who had watched pornography, who had abused their child or their husband or their wife.
who had cheated a business partner, who had lied to their spouse, and the list goes on. But when the result of the sin is visible, judgment comes much more easily. Am I saying I think females should wear revealing clothing and flaunt themselves? Of course not. But the fact that too much skin may be showing does not mean that males have an excuse for not controlling their sexual urges. We must take responsibility for our own actions and not put the blame on someone else. And I mean everyone should be held accountable for their own actions, whether they are a 16-year-old high school student, a successful businessman, a young mother, a pastor, an unemployed worker, a single person, a senior citizen, or, dare I say it, the President of the United States. The first few verses in John are pretty straightforward, but it seems like the God-fearing, Bible-believing men forgot to read the next five verses. Here is the positive. In verse 9, the woman is again standing alone. This time, only Jesus is there because the men have left. Jesus treats her with dignity and compassion. He does not tell the woman to clean up her act and then he will forgive her. He said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way. Sin no more." He said, "Now that you are saved, don't continue with your sinful lifestyle." He did not say, "Be obedient and then I will save you." He forgave her. Romans 5:8 says, "God proves his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." Often the biggest barrier to starting over can be forgiving ourselves. Past mistakes can be a source of a lot of pain, and we either play them over and over again, obsessing about them, or we try to sweep them under the rug and forget about them. But no matter what unchaste thing you have done, don't ever believe that you are worthless, and don't ever believe that you cannot start over. Remember that God doesn't love us more when we are being good and less when we aren't. God just loves us unconditionally and always. As we look at vice and virtue, we see that each case starts with something good. Vice is the result of that good thing being twisted. Being sexually attracted to someone is not a sin, and being sexually attractive is not a sin. God made the woman and man's bodies and called them good. There are three reasons for sex. One is to create human beings. But if that were the only reason, why does a woman not become pregnant every time she has sex? The second one is for pleasure. The Bible talks about our desires, and it is good. The third one is to form a bond between two married people. When you're committed to each other, that the action of having sex and giving yourself to that person helps to promote the bond that you have. Okay, but one person defines marriage as a God-blessed joining of a man to a woman wherein he has the authority of a father over her. This person says, a relationship between a man and a woman where the woman is not under the authority of her husband but is given free rein to make her own decisions is not marriage. That is contractual harlotry, the type of legal man-woman relationship most common in churches today. Do you understand why I was disheartened when I began studying? But the idea of sex as something that deepens the relationship is most important. It's give and take, putting the other person and their needs and feelings above your own. Doing something because you love the person and care for them, not doing something solely for what you get out of it. Have you heard of GIGO? I believe I'm saying that right. It's the abbreviation for garbage in, garbage out. It has to do with data being entered into a computer. So if the data that's entered into the computer is of low quality, what comes out is going to be low quality. Like when I was doing all the scanning of the Beaver Camp slides. Some of the slides were nice, some of them were not. Blurry, off-centered, you know, just what slides were like 50 years ago. And Sarah was able to do some things to change the brightness or the contrast or whatever, but if you have this blurry, odd photo, you can't fix it. It won't come out a better photo. So that's the idea between, that's the idea of if you put garbage in, you put garbage out. And it's the same thing with our minds, of course. The things that we put in, the things that we think about will have bearing on what comes out. To be chaste is to be pure in thought and actions. What we see, hear, think, and do should be pleasing to God. What we see, hear, think, and do should be done to show others we care about them and love them. As Christians, we are to live our lives as a display of God's transforming grace and mercy. May each one of us do so in the coming week. Thank you.